you know, Joe Blow or somebody, you know, sort of just got all day to write letters. But if it's someone making decisions for the country and trying to run a government, it's something you can pass on to your staff. But he couldn't do that.
Well, was he a relaxed type of person?
Yes. He seemed very relaxed. He thoroughly enjoyed going to Portsea at weekends. And he would come back on Monday morning and chat about, you know, how he went on one side or the other side of the peninsula and got a couple of crays or things. And he used to love the diving, the crayfishing and things like that. Always relaxed about that sort of thing, and Monday mornings always seemed to be relaxed and happy to talk about his swimming and his exploits underwater and so on. Later in his period as Prime Minister, of course, he wasn't quite so relaxed.
Mm. Yeah, well, we'll come to that.
Yeah.
I thought I'd take the opportunity to ask about him as you'd worked for him when he was Treasurer.
Yes.
But we will go, we'll talk about him again
in his period as
Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
So after working for Holt as Treasurer, what happened then? Where did you go from there?
It was then that I moved, it must have been mid-63, July 63, when I moved in as Private Secretary to Menzies as Prime Minister, when Bill Heseltine, who had been his Private Secretary beforehand, Bill had gone, Bob Linford had moved in. There was some reorganising anyway, and I think it was Bob Linford was there before me, and he went back to the department, to the Cabinet Office, and I moved in then in July 63. Now, I know at the time Menzies was wanting to, was hoping to appoint somebody from Attorney General, so forget his name. Oh, Alan Rose was one that he'd heard of, and he was a Rhodes Scholar and a barrister. So I think he had a good reputation in Attorney General's, and I think he finally became head of Attorney General's Department of Wonder States. But he was interested in bringing him in, but again, I think it was Alan Brown or Jack Bunting who said, well, you know, Frank's got the experience and he's got the departmental contacts. And and again, I think there was a lot of jealousy within the public service those days. And it was important for the head of Prime Minister's Department, he felt, to have someone in the PM's office who could relate personally to the people in the department, to the senior people in the department. Now you can see the arguments, and you can put the argument pretty simply that from the PM's point of view, and if he wants something done or some comments he's not sure of in some particular area or some submission he's not happy with, if he's got someone like me from the department, it's much easier for me to get onto someone and say, hey, Jack, hey, Bill, you know, this is what the PM wants, rather than someone who's come from outside and doesn't know the people in the department. This was the sort of argument that was put.
Yes.
And Menzies accepted that. So that's when I moved over to Parliament House in a slot. You wouldn't recognise it now, but I know just where it was. As you walk into the Prime Minister's suite, they got on the left hand side, you got some switchboards where Al Stafford and Chidgey were, two cabinet attendants were, and then just the wall behind them, that's where my office was, and then there was another office beyond that onto the outside wall where visiting officials would wait for the PM. As often as not, that was the head of the department or one of the senior officers in the department in there. And then just moved straight into the PM's office, which has now all been, you know, cut up and carved up into things. But
tell me how, and excuse my ignorance on this, but I was wondering, was there a formal process of applying for the job? Like, was it an advertised position, or was it within the public service?
It was a secondment from the public service, but not an advertised position. No, it was just an appointment, or I think I was given a temporary position, public service position. I think it was a class 9 position at the time. There was no permit arraigned. The superannuation things just continued, and as before, straight public service pay. I think paid by administrative services, I think, at that stage, the parliamentary staff. But at that stage, there was no requirement for advertising, nor going through the selection processes.
So there was no interview?
No interview.
No panel?
No interview at all. It just Alan Brown or Jack Bunny had talked to the PM and say, you know, we think Frank could do the job for you. And that's the way it worked. And it was the same when I was replaced later down the track. It's after Holt's time. I stayed then with Menzies until he retired. That was about, you know, 2.5 years or something. I was with him there. And I was always told that, you know, you act there and there'll be promotion back in the department, because you didn't get paid nearly enough overtime. The overtime allowance didn't cover anywhere near the hours you put in working here in Parliament House. The role then is so different. The office we had, and I think it's probably interesting to compare, you know, the office we had for the Prime Minister in 1960, 63 to 66, compared to now. There was myself as private secretary, looking after the parliamentary cabinet, general departmental stuff, and then Hazel Craig was his personal private secretary, who looked after the appointments and his personal stenography and personal accounts and things. And we had two assistant private secs and another stenographer.
Do you remember their names, by the way? I know it was a long time ago.
The two assistant private secs, one was Betty Greenwood, who was still there from back when I was here in the 50s, I think. I forget the second one.
Was it another woman?
Another woman. Mm-hmm. And then there was Mary Newport, who was really personal secretary to the press secretary. And the press secretary, I think at this stage it was Hugh Dash was still there. Whether Ray Maley had come in at that stage, so they varied. And then later on, of course, there was Tony Eggleton came in the latter time of Menzies' era. So we had a staff of 7 all up in the office. This compares now with 40-odd, but but the roles are completely different.
Well, let's talk about the actual role, the functions and duties.
I saw my role not as an advisor, and certainly not as a political advisor. The political advisor was Bob Willoughby, who was director of the Liberal Party Secretariat, and Pete Hatcher, I think it was there at the time, as his assistant. So there was a small Liberal Party secretariat who handled any of the political advising. I saw my role was basically to keep the paper flowing, get the urgent material signed and through, and make sure that the PM had available to him anything necessary for his decision making, whether it be for cabinet, parliament, or handing the general correspondence. I would have on his desk three or four trays, one with urgent, which again included, again, I was looking at all the cables that came in and out of the Commonwealth, and again sort of sifting out the ones that I thought the PM should read, the ones he might read if he's got time and could have interest in. And I would have one tray for urgent, or maybe I had one for very urgent, you know, this has got to be done. One for urgent, one for, you know, another category, and one for if you've got time. Sort of general reading stuff that you might find interesting. So I was fairly constantly shuffling these papers and files from one category to another as things became important, if they weren't handled, weren't done. And again, you had things like ASIO reports and things that some very restricted sort of documentation that had come in from time to time from, I think Spry was the Director General at that stage of ASIO.
Did you need additional clearance yourself?
The clearance, the top clearance I got from working with Sir Alan Brown was sufficient. I mean, that was as high as they went. But you certainly get, every now and again, you got this briefing from ASIO about being a good boy and not putting yourself in a position of possibly being threatened with exposure, unless you release certain information. On that particular issue, I joined, or I was encouraged to join, what they call the Refugee Club, which was basically a journalist's organisation for a start. Journalists associating with the people from the embassies below ambassador level, counsellors and that sort of level in the embassies, to give them contact, give the embassy people contact with the media, and also then with certain other people like Qantas, Commonwealth Bank, PR people in defence, and so on. I used to have a meeting once a month, a lunch meeting, and so they got me to join as well. And I found that interesting until at one meeting, we used to sit at long tables and we'd have a couple of drinks before lunch and chat and general mingling, and then we'd have lunch, and they'd often have a guest speaker. And I found that at one of these meetings, I had one member of the Soviet embassy sitting opposite and one sitting on either side. And the conversation was pretty general, about my likes and dislikes and so on. And then I found that I was given records of some music that I would like and tickets to a Moscow circus or ballet or something like that. So, you know, my first reaction to this was when that lunch finished, I drafted a note to Sir John Bunning, head of the department, and reported. So there was this feeling that the Soviet embassy might have been trying to encourage me. Mm. Those are the sort of things that you become aware of or get scared of or get very cautious of. But, you know, my first thing was to report back to head of the department so that I could go on to ASIO. Yeah. Interesting on that, I tried to get my ASIO file since then, since I've retired. Oh, yeah. And through archives this was, and I got about 3 pages back, saying there were X number of more pages involved, but of the pages I got back, there was nothing much in it apart from my name and and officers' names all blanked out, and the rest of it, the reason they gave was that release of the Mr. Jennings' file would indicate modes of operation or something of ASIO. So, you know, I'm not too sure about that one, but I haven't followed through on that. So the role
yes.
The role strictly was, you know, paper management, as I saw it, and making sure that the PM was able to do his job as best he could, and as fluently as he could. And it wasn't difficult, as I said earlier, it wasn't difficult to get to know his style in terms of preparing answers to correspondence. We didn't answer a lot of correspondence here in the office. Most of that was done in the department, all the official stuff. And then a lot of the really personal stuff was done by Hazel Craig. So mine was mainly the, you know, the prioritising, if you like, of the paper flow, and I found that was enough because there was a tremendous amount of paper. I think it was something like it was 1,000 cables a week or something like that for a start. That's without the correspondence and your cabinet papers and things and your stuff coming from the Liberal Party. Although there wasn't a lot of paper coming from the Liberal Party, most of that was done just by Bob Willoughby coming over and having a chat to the PM. And again, that's, you know, Bob would ring me up and say, you know, what's the PM's mood like? He said, I want to talk to him about something, but I want him in a good mood before I do. I said, well, maybe you should leave that till tomorrow. And as these grunts and groans sort of type things that were helpful to people like the party secretary or the department matter. Not that Menzies was in a grumpy mood too often, but it did happen occasionally. And
what about the relations within the office?
The relations were, they were very good, I think. Hazel Craig and I, you know, I mentioned earlier that Alan Brown said, Jill, you won't have much trouble working with the PM, but you might have with Hazel Craig. She's, you know, she sees him as her PM because she's been with him since 39 or something. Hazel and I sorted out our areas of responsibility early in the piece, and after that there was never any hassles. I don't recall any harsh words anywhere. It was a nice, easygoing office. I don't recall any eruptions. We all had our part to play, whether it be the press secretary, the private secretary, or me. And I think we stuck to our bits of dirt. And in doing that, you know, we didn't cross swords or paths. It was all pretty clear cut. And as I say, we weren't in... Well, occasionally, if, say, the press secretary and I were travelling with the PM to a function somewhere by car, he might ask for our comments on something. And generally reprimand us because we didn't give him enough ideas. But then feeding him ideas wasn't our plot, you know, so it wasn't our job. It was interesting with Menzies, he wrote all his own speeches on... He'd get notes from the department, you know, pinpoint notes on a particular issue. But then he'd handwrite in pencil his speech, and then he might pass it on, might have it typed here, and then pass it on to the department to have a look at. But he'd do a lot of that work himself. And, you know, what impressed me at one stage pretty early was, I think it was a question of Pakistan or somewhere in the Middle East, Israel or something like that. There was a major speech he had for the House, but he went back over the whole history, and he'd set the pattern, set the background before he'd come to the point that he wanted to make. And so that sort of form of speech writing impressed me a fair bit at the time. And of course, he was very, very fluent use of the language. He used to get a bit angry with certain officers in the department. You could pick them if they use a word like, let's think of one that gets misused pretty often. Decimated. Decimated was one that he hated. You know, you get one from the one of the particularly one of the officers in the economic area, and say, you know, the drought has decimated the stock or something, and he put a pencil through this and he said, "What? Only 10%? Only 1% or 10%?" He said, "Nah."
to us today, the conditions under which you worked seemed cramped. You know, the rooms seem small for the number of people by today's standards. I'm wondering, did you feel physically comfortable back then?
We weren't particularly worried. I didn't hear the girls complaining. And this little office here, there were four girls working in this office, plus all the stationery and the filing cabinets. And
we're recording in room 86. I should.
All right. Yes.
We know which office you mean.
Right. There were no complaints. I mean, that's what we were given. That's what we accepted. We didn't have all this OHMS sort of occupation health and safety OHS. We didn't have all that sort of stuff those days. We didn't have unions jumping up and down saying you can't put people in that little slot. There's not enough air and too many people. And I think we just accepted what we were given. And you know, that was just the nature of the thing, and that's what we had to put up with.
Do you remember your very first day working for Menzies?
Not specifically.
It must have been.
No, I was a bit overawed for a start. I know because, working for the PM and the big fellow who'd been there for, you know, a long, long time and knew what he was on about. I was replacing a much more senior officer than I had, and I think the public service used me a fair bit, or Prime Minister's Department did, in terms of putting me into positions that had previously been held by assistant secretaries and first assistant secretaries. They were giving me jobs that, well, beyond my capacity, supposedly, according to the range I was being paid. But I found that a challenge, and I didn't fuss too much about that. I was a bit more interested in the interest in the jobs. Sort of being at first-hand association with the great man was a bit overawing for an hour or two, but I found him easy to work with, and he pacified me pretty quickly. There was no outburst, from him at any stage. One thing that I always remembered, he would never drink on his own. He'd always have a couple of martinis before he went home for dinner. And he'd always have a couple of scotches when he left in the evening after work. But he'd never go in and drink on his own. If Parliament wasn't sitting, there were no ministers about, he'd invite me in to have a drink. And that's where there were lots of, and the chat was not work, really work, family. And, you know, he really loved the, his kids and grandkids, and talk about sort of bouncing the kids on his legs and knees and things like that, the grandkids. And, you know, they were good times, and he'd talk about my kids and so on. And cricket, of course. Cricket, you would get an honourable mention more often than not. And general things that are happening day to day, but rarely did it get to any hard political issues. Occasionally he'd bounce something off us, off me, but, you know, he didn't have me there for ideas. The ideas came from his political party or from the department.
How frequently would that happen? I mean, the martinis.
The martinis and things.
Drink and...
Well, if Parliament wasn't sitting, it might be 3 or 4 days a week.
But you would have a
drink with him. It depends. If there were other people around that, you know, if there are other members around he was like to have a drink with and a chat with, we'd get them around at you know, 6 o'clock or whatever, or 10:30 at night, before heading off home, 10 o'clock, 10:30. Yeah, it'd happen a few times a week. I remember once he came out, it must have been about 10:30, and probably a Thursday night at the end of a parliamentary week, and I was asleep on the desk on my papers, and put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Okay, laddie, time to go home." I was always laddie. So, you know, how can you get angry when the boss calls you laddie? but he was often thought of as arrogant and you know, a dictator in cabinet and so on. But I remember one day cabinet was sitting, and while cabinet was sitting, I could go in and do some reshuffles of the papers and so on. And I went in, and here he is sitting at his desk reading. And I thought, you know, what's on? So I backed out again, and I found later that he'd been rolled in cabinet by Jack McEwen. So he'd come out of the cabinet, and he was reading Shakespeare to settle himself down, presumably. And he did this for half an hour or so, and then he went back into cabinet. So, yeah, and I found it next day in the papers and things, or the stories around the house, that, you know, Jack McEwen had had a win, and the PM wasn't wanting him to have a win. So his relaxation or getting himself together a bit was to come out and read Shakespeare.
I don't suppose you remember which Shakespeare
was reading. No. It was a green-covered book.
You can't give us too many anecdotes like that, Frank, for this purpose of recording the oral history.
Okay. But,
the anecdotes are what often gives the insight.
Yes.
I think that one is a classic, really.
Yes, it was one that I've recalled and you know, I've written into my book. So there's a few like that, I think. It's like when cabinet was meeting, I mentioned earlier Alf Stafford and Chidgey were outside in the little ante room, and Alf and Chidgey used to provide his tea or drinks or whatever he wanted, or the cups of tea for the cabinet when they broke for tea and all that sort of thing. But Alf would always listen to the cricket, and every now and again he'd go into the cabinet room and slip a bit of paper that, you know, someone's out, someone's got a century. So he'd keep the PM informed during cabinet meetings of the progress of test matches or shield matches. So, you know, the affairs of government must go on, but you must keep the boss happy.
Yes. And with Chidgey?
Chidgey. A.O. Chidgey.
Is that his real surname?
Yeah, Chidgey's his surname, and they used to call him Chidge. I'm not too sure what his Christian name was now, but it was A.O. were his initials.
Do you know what nationality he was?
Oh, he seemed to be British Australian, as far as I can see. Yeah.
Interesting surname.
Yeah, Chidgey. Mm.
Any more you'd like to tell me about Menzies in terms of character and personality?
Yeah, well, perhaps I suppose it explains him a bit in that when we, at the end of each week, well, at the end of a lot of weeks, say on the Friday, he'd often go to Melbourne for the weekend, and we'd stay at the Hotel Windsor. We'd travel, there'd only be two or three staff to travel with him, depending what was happening. There'd be myself and often Betty Greenwood as an assistant private sec, or Hazel Craig, and the press secretary sometimes, as required. Often there are only two of us. Friday night, we'd have dinner with PM and Dame Patty at the Hotel Windsor. That was fixed. You know, first meals with staff, and he would we'd get settled down. We'd leave here mid-afternoon and fly to Melbourne in a Vickers Viscount or whatever we had at that stage in the VIP flight, and we'd settle into our rooms. And about 5:30, he'd ring me up and say, "Come on round, laddie, bring the girls round." And so we'd go around, and he'd have the martinis mixed, ready. We'd have two martinis, and then the four or five of us would go down to the dining room for dinner. If generally it was just the group, the family groups they called. But if someone like I'd check when I got there to see if someone like Eddie Kennellan was in town or at the hotel, staying at the hotel. Eddie Kennellan was. From the Northern Territory, cattleman, one of the original aircraft people, and had and developed Kennellan Airways in the centre. Quite an interesting character, and the PM loved his company. So if Eddie was in town, he always stayed at the Windsor, and if he was there, he was invited to dinner as well. But I can't think of anyone else that was in that sort of category. But you know, that was indicative of the man in terms of treating the staff. I remember, and Dame Patty was just a darling as well. You know, sort of. It was all just pleasant family chit chat sort of stuff over dinner generally. I remember once. I was, for some reason or other, I was on my own with him and Dame Patty. Don't know what had happened to the girls. They must have been doing something else. But he invited me around, and he'd mixed up the six martinis for the three of us. But Dame Patty wasn't coming to the party. She wasn't playing speaks. So rather than... waste them, we had three martinis instead of two, and the PM's martinis were fairly strong, and I wasn't much of a drinker, and I remember following PM and Dame Patty down into the dining room, and I felt as if my knees were coming up to my chin as I was high stepping into the dining room. but generally on those occasions, on the Saturday we might have a function on the Saturday, but then Saturday night he'd probably go to catch up with some of his family, his son, Ken and family in Melbourne. And if that happened, if there was no official function on, or I would just duck down the road and see if I'd get a seat at Her Majesty's Theatre. That's about the one of the few places I've seen live theatre, but I used to get some good shows there. So I often got most Saturday nights off, and only wanting one seat, it was fairly often easy for them to fit me in, sort of, as I got to be known there. I guess I should sort of mention too some of the more enjoyable times were when we went to Sydney and stayed at Kirribilli House. Because there it was, again, it was just family. All the meals, were, breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever, we were all just staff in with the PM and Dame Patty, which was always very pleasant, knowing where Kirribilli is situated on the harbour, and it was great. I had a particular interest in Kirribilli because at one stage, when it was just being renovated as a government guest house sort of place, or PM's residence or government guest house, Ken Hurdy from the department, Prime Minister's department, was given the job to get it renovated. And remember, there was a lot of work done on designing wallpaper that depicted some Australian history and all that sort of thing, and selecting books for the library and whatever. And selecting someone to be cook caretaker, like Tom and what was his wife's name? Tom Ferry and his wife, Mary. Anyway, they were the cook caretakers, it was when the restoration had been finished. The first people in, Sir Alan Brown and I, were the first people to live in. And we had to sort of test the plumbing upstairs and downstairs and see how many coat hangers there were, and, you know, see if they were all adequate in the different rooms and so on. So, you know, my Kirribilli meant something to me. Oh, it still does.